Could you teach one to tell a joke?
Well, let's see. Two drunks walk into a bar.
Wouldn't two drunks walk out of a bar, sir? You walk into a bar to drink, and you come out drunk.
Hello, listening people!
Hello!
Hello, Bartek, how are you doing?
Good, Vietnam. How are you, Ryan?
Good morning and good evening, good afternoon, whatever.
And good night.
Good night. I said it in the wrong order, but let's pretend I didn't.
Two great quotes from 20 to 1 movie quotes.
Sure. That's inside baseball for those out there. 20 to 1 was an Australian TV classic, and we all miss Bert Newton. I hope one day his son Matt Newton will take up the mantle of bringing back what was Watch Mojo for television before Watch Mojo. But we are Ryan and Bartek, and you are listening to Spit and Polish Presents Pictures Powwow, a show that we do on a regular basis in which we sit down and we talk about a movie that we have watched, movies that come recommended. We have a mode of recommendations. It goes in an order. Bartek recommends it one week, then the week after that it is myself, and then after that it is you, the listening people. So you should make sure to recommend movies to us. We have our list of listening people's suggestions, and we're getting a bit low on that list, so we need some suggestions to top it up. But this week, it is me. I recommended a film here on PP, the original PP, that is Pictures Powwow. And what film did I recommend? Well, I'm looking around the room. Bartek, can you find the movie? Is it somewhere in this room? Is it hiding underneath you? What movie did I make us watch this week? Do you know? I can't see it anywhere in here.
Ryan, which question do I answer first?
All of it.
All of them? What was the first question you asked?
How are you?
Good. Next question.
You know what? That one answer applies to all of them. Where is, what movie did I recommend? Is it in the room with us? Where is it? Do you know? Good. We are actually talking about the 1999 film Bicentennial Man, directed by Christopher Columbus, starring Robin Williams, and music by the late, great James Horner. And people, we are going to talk about this in depth with more detail, spoilers. If you have not seen the 1999 film Bicentennial Man, we say that you should check it out for yourself. But what would you tell people, Bartek, about Bicentennial Man if they hadn't seen it, but you were trying to let them know what happened in this, what it's about, or just a general recommendation to get someone enticed to give it a view for themselves?
I think this one, you can give a pretty simple synopsis, and that is that it is about a robot servant who starts gaining human emotions thanks to a malfunction, and over the course of his very long life becomes more and more human, like literally, like biologically, and looking at the sort of discrimination he faces along the way and the way he gets around, you know, becoming more human despite being artificial.
That is a great summary of the film, and of course there's hijinks and philosophical musings, all of the things that you would expect from a story about mechanical life, artificial intelligence, robots, and if they are sentient, if they are human, do they have a soul, do they have a consciousness, are they just programming, are they just cogs, are they things that you repair it, and that means it's non-human, non-alive, and the hilarity of a Robin Williams comedy shtick in there as well. It's the balancing act of those things, of a, I guess, of a light affair Robin Williams family comedy and the more heady science fiction tale here. And do these things wrestle with one another throughout the runtime? Do they commingle in harmony, or are they just sticking out like two sore thumbs? Well, we'll hear about it as we get into the conversation. Now, Bartek, have you seen Bicentennial Man before?
I have, once before.
And What was your experience with that like?
So it was roughly 10 years ago, maybe 9, but not 8, definitely not 8. I was in Poland visiting my family there, my dad, and a lot of nights when I was there, we'd just sit down in the living room and just shoot the shit. Sometimes he'd put something on and he was like, oh yeah, I've got this film here on the TV. Your stepmom and your sister really like it. I've tried watching it a million times, but I just keep falling asleep. Why don't I show it to you? And it was by Centennial Man.
Did it have a lector?
No. This was just, you know, straight up original audio, maybe polished subtitles, maybe he turned them off. I don't even know, but, you know, it was in English. I made it all the way through. He fell asleep, obviously.
Do you remember when he fell asleep?
No, I don't.
Damn. Damn. I wonder if there's a certain thing that just sets him into sleep mode, like how Robin Williams is in this movie. Your dad, you turn around, you saw your dad take a power cord out of his chest and plug it into a wall for that one time.
He's the type to fall asleep when watching a movie, like the mm-hmm. evening. So it didn't surprise me when it happened.
Like father, like son. Yes.
It's been a while, thankfully. Thankfully, for me. Yeah. Yes. I finished the film both times without falling asleep. You're welcome.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
I'm so great. I watched Bicentennial Man twice.
Do you know that Robin Williams was a huge fan of anime? Yeah. And he loved Evangelion. Mm-hmm. That was one of his favorites. Yeah. So that little reference, that was deliberate. It was a little nod to Robin Williams in his fascination with Japanese culture. And I'll just point this out. The film 1 Hour Photo, there's a child in that movie who's holding one of the angels, and he tells the child that that's one of the heroes.
It's one, yeah, no, I think the child tells him, like, oh, it's one of the good guys beats up the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there's a video on YouTube of, like, you know, half opacity, it, like, destroying Asuka.
Nice. But you were saying you actually made it through this time on the watching of it, just both like times. Like you did last time.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was keen to check it out again because I remembered, you know, the general gist of it and liking it. And yeah, seeing how it holds up 10 years after.
You liked it that first time.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. This was one in which it was always on, just always on. Just TV would put this on any time of day, any day of the week. I swear I've watched this on a Sunday afternoon. I swear I've seen Bicentennial Man on a Friday night. And it's just one of those movies that was always in the rotation, especially of Robin Williams. I'm not a huge Robin Williams fan. I'm not a hater. There are a few core pieces of his work that are near and dear to me because of that childhood nostalgia and fondness. Jumanji is a movie that still gets me very emotional, and in part because of how good Robin Williams was in that movie. Aladdin, on the other hand, is one that I never really gelled with me as a kid, even, and his shtick in that was not for my taste. There's been other movies of his that have always just been around my life, but overall I've never thought of myself as a big Robin Williams fan. He's just somebody that, he's one of those big comedic figures that you recognize, and like I said, even enjoy the work of from time to time, but they're not your person. It's like how people are like big Jim Carrey fans, like, oh, love. And I've expressed this on the podcast before, like there are comedians like that for me in which I'm like, oh, I love this comedian. I love this comedic force. I mean, you and I are kind of like that with Mike Myers in a way where we grew up with Mike Myers and have a bunch of his stuff. And we've covered pretty much most of his movies at this point on the pod. Like, not,
have we?
I mean, live action films. He doesn't have where he's the lead.
Yeah.
We haven't done Cat in the Hat. That's the other crowning jewel we haven't really cracked into. But Bicentennial Man, near and dear to my heart. I have such a fondness for this movie. And I said it at the end of the last discussion, but I always think of Sam Neill's performance in this as like one of the things that leaps out. And when I think of him as an actor, he is one I have a fondness for. I love Sam Neill. I've always had such an affinity for him as an actor. I think he's such a versatile actor, and yet he always brings that certain Sam Neill quality. And when I think of him as a performer, Bicentennial Man is honestly something that leaps to my mind before even Jurassic Park, which I know is sacrilegious for many people out there because that's the big thing for them.
Right, don't worry, I haven't seen it.
I know you haven't seen it, but even you know from pop culture osmosis, like Jurassic Park is a huge thing and he's in that movie. And so that's like cemented in his career. But for me, it's like, I think of Bicentennial Man before that, when it comes to him as an actor, but
he's great in this.
I love him in this. And Bicentennial Man is a movie that I have loved. I have an affection for, but also a very divided relationship with it because I like the first section of the movie, the first half.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half, I'm like your dad. Very sleepy, not so much of it retains. Even going into it today to watch it for this and talk about it, there was so much in that second half that was basically new to me. Everything in the first half, like right up until Sam Neill dies, basically, it was just like going back down memory lane. Oh, I remember this, this detail, this detail, this detail, this detail, this line delivery, this image, this piece of music. And then that second half comes around and it's like a completely new thing to me.
Yeah.
And yet it's in the same movie. And I must admit, even last night, I found myself kind of like I was when I was 12 years old watching this, drifting off a little bit, just kind of aimless a little bit. My eye looking around saying, okay, where's that movie I liked just like 15 minutes ago?
It's very fun. I had almost the same experience where, one thing I really like about this movie overall is that it's an epic. It covers the entire life of this one character, which spans 2 years, hence Bicentennial Man.
200 years.
Shit, you're right.
Yeah.
Ryan, yeah. In editing, add me saying 100 in. I'll say it now. 100!
No.
Oh.
Sorry. You fucked yourself.
Right. Well, he spends...
It's such an epic. It covers the lifespan of not even a dog. It covers the lifespan of maybe a really ill goldfish.
So it covers 0.02 years of this robot's life. And he goes through so much. There's, you know, the time jumps all over the film, which... You know, both is like a thing of like, oh, wow, the things are really going to change. But also it's such a casual thing because for him, you know, time passing doesn't mean all that much. It just,
As Sam Neill says.
And it goes through so many emotions. But then by the end, the gravitas of that kind of goes away and it becomes, I guess, it becomes like a romantic comedy when for most of the film that really wasn't what it was going for. And you start getting all these kind of, you know, tropes and cliches that are very prevalent in other films, but weren't as prevalent in the first half of this one.
Yeah. I always think of, with Bicentennial Man, him and the family. Him as this robot servant in the family, slowly gaining his humanity, and the scenes of him late at night, sitting with Sam Neill, learning what it is to be human and becoming his own man. Obviously having romantic entanglements with the little miss, the young daughter, as she grows up and she begins to love him, but it's this unrequited love because it cannot be. I remember all of this. I even remember the sister being a bitch, and I remember the mum just never being on board with thinking that Andrew's a person, and even the comedic moments I look at and I have this smile because it all lines up. I think that first... like hour or so of this really is a solid piece. Now, this is based on an Isaac Asimov story. I haven't read that particular story, and I wouldn't be shocked if this is nothing like it because it's Hollywood. That is always the case. I've seen I, Robot, and that film is nothing like I, Robot, the book, because I, Robot, the book is a series of short stories.
We've been talking about Hollywood a lot lately.
Yes. And I, Robot, the book, is a series of funny short stories. That's the thing that they won't tell you, is I, Robot is very funny. There's a whole story in I, Robot in which these dipshits are stuck on like a mining colony or something like that. And one of the robot servants or one of the robot workers becomes a Jesus for all of the other robots. and these two guys are just stuck in their office, and they don't, and their solution to the problem of a robotic messiah figure who is making a rallying cry for all of the other robots to rise up against humanity is to look how long their contract is and just wait it out and let the next group of people deal with it. Mm-hmm. That's the story. And then later on, you get to see those two dipshits again. But it's a whole thing. But this, I really do, I don't have any clue, but I wouldn't be shocked if the first bit of this movie is like the book or the story itself, because it's so well realized. You see the life and death of the father figure of this family, and Andrew kind of grow up himself and gain his freedom, get money, get clothes, and then the movie just keeps going. And it's one of those things, I don't know if you feel this way, it's one of those things where if we both said out loud Andrew's journey through humanity to his eventual growing old and dying, you said it out loud, it sounds like it all adds up and makes sense and like slots into place, and that should be entertaining. Like, as you said, it's this epic story about the lifespan of one android who eventually, like one robot who becomes an android who becomes a person. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like all of that should flow together. What's the problem? Why is there this divide in the middle, or like after a certain point in the movie? And I've been pondering that for so long, because I didn't know as a kid when I watched it, like, why is there a disconnect for me with this? And even now, as I'm sitting here talking about it, and I'm thinking of, like, well, after the dad dies, you know, Andrew, you know, goes and does this, and he goes on this quest, and he becomes more of a human physically speaking, and he learns about, like, social cues, and he learns that you have to make mistakes, and yet he still has that part of him that wants the affinity of people he serves, and eventually he grows old and he dies, and the cycle is going to continue with a new generation of artificial life with, what was her name again?
Galatea,
where she's going to be the next type of Andrew, where she's a person and she's this. Sounds all great. I don't know why that it just, after Sam Neill dies, my emotion, I guess it's that my emotional investment is just, it ends there.
Mm-hmm.
It just ends after Sam Neill dies and maybe the elderly version of Little Miss. After that point, it's like, I guess I just don't care because I'm spending it with characters who I don't know about or I don't feel for. Even though I like Andrew, I don't feel for Oliver Platt's character as Rupert, or I don't feel the same way for any of those characters in the back half like I did with the first half, where, yeah, they use the cheesy little tricks of the little pony he carved for Little Miss is the thing she's holding on to when she dies. It's a simple trick. Damn, did it work on me. But her granddaughter? I don't know. There's this part of me that's resigned to the fact of, like, she's not a person I care about. And I don't know why, but for myself, I never get past that. Like, once that family is gone, and now we're following, like, the later generations of them and the new sets of characters, I just throw my hands up in the air and say, I just don't care, honestly.
Yeah, for me, I think it is a bit more pointed, like when the granddaughter, the Portia character, gets introduced.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the point for me where it's like, okay, the film's kind of veered off, you know, the pinnacle of its entertainment value, because Andrew, you know, comes to the house and he's got this whole thing about how, I don't like that she looks like younger you. It's like, okay, that's a character quirk for you, but, like, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that such a bothersome thing for you?
Why is he a jerk?
Yeah, and there's just a lot of weird tension between them early on that almost gets brushed off like it's nothing after a certain point, where it's like, why did it need to be there? Or why is this, you know, newfound fondness for each other deserved? It's like, did you need both? Either one. Yeah, it just becomes a bit weird. Like, the first half of the film, you know, we get all those time skips. It's like he's going on these journeys, he's discovering something new. And then once he meets the granddaughter character, it becomes a lot more concentrated. He's not going out on, you know, it wasn't really an adventure, but like a quest. He's I guess he's focusing on becoming more human at that point, which is still very interesting, but...
But he takes it to a literal level rather than the philosophical, which is what the first part was doing. I don't need him to physically look like a human for me, at least, to understand the journey of what it is to be human. In the second half, it is very much like, I've got a stomach! And I'm like, sure.
Okay, yeah, you know what? I actually wasn't really thinking of that angle of like, oh yeah, literally becoming human kind of was... You know, maybe going steps too far, but yeah, maybe you're right. That would be a point too.
Here's a thing I want to just ponder. This is the thing I want to put forth, and then I want to go back and go through some positives because we're jumping on the things that don't work, but there's so much that does work in this. Even though this is a surprisingly low-rated movie. It's in the middle on IMDb. You go to Rotten Tomatoes, it's like 30%. Like, it's all over the place. People love this movie. People hate this movie. People are middle of the road. Everyone's got their... It's a broad spectrum of reactions.
Low to middling, and then there are people that love it. Yeah.
Yes. But here's my major concern when I was watching it last night. Does he, Andrew, did he love... And did he recognize that he had love for Little Miss? We know she loved him, but did he ever love her? The original Little Miss, not the granddaughter, the original one. Did he love her in a romantic way, not just a platonic or familial way? What do you think?
I don't think it was a romantic love.
And yet, he brings up during his pursuit of Portia, the granddaughter, that is this him repeating the same mistake and waiting too late?
I see, right.
And if that's the case, is Portia actually someone he loves, or is she a consolation for what he lost out on?
Yeah, I think that's a fumbling of the writing. I really don't think there was... Especially early on, like the romantic love with Little Miss.
Yeah. But with what is presented, what does that make you think and feel? Because that back half, as you said, is very much leaning into it being a romantic drama / comedy. And that is there, where he makes it pretty clear that a part of the reason this pursuit is important to him is because he doesn't want to go through the same mistakes again. And yet she teaches him you've got to make mistakes. To be human. But I also agree, I never felt like he loved Little Miss in that way. He was loved by her in that way, and did he even recognize, even at the very end of the movie, that Little Miss loved him the way that he thinks he loves Portia? Like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that's a difficult thing to chew on with this movie, because I can't abide by either options of it. Like, if Portia's someone he truly loves, and yet he doesn't recognize the past of like, oh, the grandmother loved me, what does that mean? There's just so many points in this movie where Andrew is really intelligent, emotionally speaking, and then other points it's like, he doesn't know certain things that you're like, but you would know this after everything we've seen. I just find it difficult. And honestly, in my opinion, I bring this up because I can't shake off the feeling that Portia is a consolation prize.
Mm.
They literally had to cast the same actress to play this character, and they make a point of like, oh, genetic thingamabob. But like, that's a deliberate choice to make it the same actress. And to me, I can't wash off the sickness of it just reads as she's a given. Like, Portia, he's in love with her because she's there and she looks like the girl from the past that he didn't get to get with.
I guess I just saw it as a thing of like, you know, he's in the second half of the film, he's discovering new emotions, and you know, he's suddenly feeling love, and the fact that it happens to be Little Miss's granddaughter, you know, is just, I don't want to say coincidence, but it's just a thing that's there. I don't really think there was too much of an element of him, you know, reevaluating his past relationship.
And yet he has the ability to reevaluate the fact that she's repeating the grandmother's past relationship by marrying a person that's vapid and a jerk and someone that is a mistake. Even to the point in which her job is to restore things.
Yeah, true.
Like, I'm not joking, like, this movie goes out of its way to make deliberate little touches and big statements about what I'm talking about here, and yet you and I are both unsure, uneasy.
I'm worried because it's like I'm worried that maybe I'm misremembering the film and I'm like fixing it in my head.
Yeah.
It's like maybe I missed something.
And maybe I'm doing the opposite where I'm like, am I just looking at this movie being like, ah, there's something that doesn't work for me. Is it these things?
Yeah. Like,
give me an answer, like, please, movie.
Yeah, like with the angle you were talking about there where it's like, oh, she's repeating the past mistakes of her grandmother and, you know, he's trying to do something about it. Like, I could see an angle of like, oh, I remember this happening to your grandmother and, you know, I'll try to help you out of it. But again, I don't think that's the angle the film went with. I think that's what I'm just putting on it.
Yeah, he doesn't explicitly say that. But when the grandmother, when little Miss got married, he had that big expression on it. He had his new face.
Yeah.
And then when she left with him, you saw it drop into sadness. Why was he sad in that moment, if he did not have any feelings for her? That's what the movie plays with. If you're using movie logic,
yeah,
which this does, that's what it reads into. So when he's with the granddaughter, he's making sure that this doesn't happen again. But again, I just don't like that.
I mean, it could have been just leading into the very next scene where he's having the heart-to-heart with Sir Sam Neill.
That's it too. Now to go back to some things that did work, some positives. What were some things that you very much gelled with or liked about Bicentennial Man?
At the risk of, you know, kind of repeating what you're saying about, like, the Sam Neill portion, just a lot of those moments of Andrew learning things were just really great. Like, the comedy one especially was really nice. You know, where he does make the family laugh, but he, like, fucks up the intended way of doing it.
Yes.
And then even after that, like, he says one more dig that just kills them. It's like little moments like that were great. I remember this was, like, one of the first moments, like, when he first gets taken down to his basement room and he's learning, you know, what good night means. And Sam Neill, you know, just says, like, no, you're only meant to say it once. And he just points out, you know, not snarkily, but, like, he just points out, like, ah, otherwise it'd be an endless cycle. Just, like, you know, little conclusions, like, oh, yes, that would be the problem if it kept going. Like, little lines like that were really great.
They were. Sam Neill, he plays this so masterfully, because the first quarter of the film, he plays this rich dad with this kind of airiness to him, kind of a little bit of a goofball. He's the one that doesn't see any of the problems that everyone else in the family has. Like, it scares the little girl, the older daughter's pissed off, and the mother is just, like, irked by Andrew. And he just doesn't really see that. But Sam Neill, He's really leaning into his comedic work here, because when he's playing off of Andrew in that first quarter of the movie, he just has these wry smiles to himself and just this, like, cock of the head, and just, he's always bemused is what I would say. Even in, like, that moment of, like, the conversation loop, it's never like he gets annoyed,
yeah,
or angry, or like, oh, this robot's an idiot. It's always like, oh, that's a fascinating little quirk there. And it always is like,
this is something I'm going to have to unteach you.
Yes. He doesn't literally do this all the time, but he always has a chuckle to himself, is how I would describe Sam Neill.
The sex talk scene was a pretty good one.
Oh, of course, of course. And just, he's always got a chuckle to himself as his performance style. Not literally all the time, but you can tell just in his body language every time he's interacting with Andrew in that first 20 minutes or so, it's always just like this robot.
And you know what? There were times where I was like, oh, come on, really, to him? But I kind of like that the film didn't make him like a perfect paragon of that part of the film, where there were legitimate moments where, like, he was the one who was like putting his foot down, saying no, and like, you know, when Little Miss was an adult, like she would then tell him, but Dad, this is because of you kind of stuff. It was really, you know, playing around with a lot of tropes of like the father figure of a family. Like, you know, we meet this character and he's doing, I guess, the typical thing of like, oh, Dad bought a video camera and he's showing off the new technology to the family and they just don't get it, but with like, you know, a robot servant. And then, yeah, he's the one that has a problem with, you know, him asking for his freedom, you know, mixed feelings there.
Wanting clothes, even. Was a thing that he was a bit mixed on. And then he was like, oh, you know what? Yeah, okay, he's
on Andrew's side, like, you know, 87% of the time. But the other 13% is like, oh, come on, I thought you were beyond this. But, yeah, it felt very realistic.
He was the one that firmly planted the idea of do not put your emotions into it. It's just a machine.
Mm.
Even though he liked having these conversations and teaching Andrew, at his heart, until the very end, he didn't believe that Andrew was more than a machine.
Yeah.
Hence, there's that great sequence where he goes to the robotics place, and he takes them there. He takes Andrew there to see what their reaction would be to this robot having had gone through this. Is it a malfunction? Is this a special thing? And he's unique. Yeah. Andrew is unique. And then that's just when Sam Neill really leans into the idea of like, okay, we're changing up what your dynamic is. You're no longer a servant in the way that we had you before. You're going to be a business person. You're going to do this and this and this and this, because Andrew is a unique product. And so Sam Neill's going to wring that out for all of its worth. But it's that thing of like, he's so supportive, and yet also Sam Neill plays it in this way of, it's also a little bit of a self-serving relationship that the dad has, where it again bemuses him to have drinks late at night and talk about sex with the house robot.
Yeah, it could be like, oh, you know, never had a son, or it's like, oh, another man around.
That is true. He has daughters, so that is a thing to highlight as well. Like a son-like figure,
and him focusing on like, oh, you know, but this is like unique. This is special. Kind of is rung later again in the film when Oliver Platt is telling Andrew that the secret to, you know, being relatable is like, you got to have those imperfections.
Sam Neill, his character also gets very teary-eyed when they watch back the footage of the wedding, and it's about the fact that you have to accept that they will leave you, that people will go. And that's a big recurring idea and theme in the movie. Hence, he gets upset at Andrew for wanting freedom, because Andrew is leaving. That's what he focuses on. So you're leaving. And Andrew said he would always be here. And Andrew is still saying, I will be here. But the dad, he hears what he had known, which is everyone leaves in the end. And that's what Andrew learns as well during the course of things. Hence, he wants to become mortal. Hence, he wants to become just like humans, because being an android or a robot or a mechanical thing that's immortal, you watch all of your loved ones die. And what's the benefit of that? Especially when time becomes this irrelevant thing. We even get that sensation in the movie with all of these time jumps. At first, it's like, oh, okay, wow, impressive. But by the end of the movie, when they keep jumping through time, it's almost like a routine.
Mm.
And you get that sense of like, oh, this is what it's like for Andrew. Just 15 years will go by within a cut for him. Like, even though he's been walking across the country and doing whatever.
Yeah, they played a few different ways. Like, the first one's this really beautiful piano sequence. I thought that was just breathtaking. Then you have a couple where it's like, this many years later, and then it's just like, we're not even telling you anymore. Just look, she's old now.
Yeah, they played around with it very much so. Robin Williams, what do you think about him in this film?
I liked him in this film, yeah. Like, for most of it, I was actually wondering, like, oh, is that him, like, embodying at the beginning of the film the robot, or is that, like, a suit? Because it looked really intricate.
Yeah.
And it still does, you know, 2024. It's really amazing. And I really like the trivia point where it's, like, they tried getting, not stunt doubles, but, like, body doubles to do some scenes, and, like, they just could not match his mannerisms, so he had to do every scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is really good in this. Again, his comedic timing, even while playing like the robotic character, really great. He really nailed it, I think.
Robin Williams was a very talented comedic force. That's obvious. It's what he will be remembered for. It's what he loved doing, clearly. But he was such a great actor, just actor in general. He really was. And we often hear about like these comedians, especially I feel like we've moved a little bit beyond it now, but the idea of like the comedy guy who becomes a dramatic actor, like Jim Carrey, we mentioned him before, like that was a big deal when he did stuff like The Truman Show or Eternal Sunshine of Spotless Mind.
Yeah, Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Yeah, Sonic the, yeah. But I feel like, I don't know, maybe because I'm older now, maybe I'm looking back and not thinking about today, but I feel like it's less of an impressive thing today if a comedic actor did a serious role like it was with people like Robin Williams, with people like Jim Carrey, and with people like Eddie Murphy and so on. Obviously, still, it's something to note down, like, oh, this comedic actor did really good in this drama, but...
Or it's like, oh, Peele won an Oscar.
Yeah, but I feel like it's less of a like a thing to note down. But with someone like Robin Williams, he was so known for his manic performance style comedically that when you see him as Andrew, and it's the exact opposite. He's so subdued, he's so restrained in his vocal delivery, in his physical delivery, that when at the end of the movie he gets to become Robin Williams, the person, then he gets to do the Robin Williams things, like the big facial expressions, the yelling, the over-the-top stuff. But it's earned by that point because he, as an actor, stayed in the lane of what was required rather than sometimes you see these bigger-than-life figures, they just can't help themselves, even if the role doesn't require it. They just can't help but be the funny person you know or the over-the-top performance style. And I think he did a really good job in this. I love Robin Williams' voice at the best of times. I think he was he had a really unique voice.
It's a really fun voice to listen to.
It's a fun one to do an impersonation of and stuff like that. You hear people do it and it's always fun. And I thought he was really good. I just don't think the movie needed him to physically show up at the way he did. I don't know. I still feel conflicted because on paper, it all lines up. But when I'm actually watching the movie, that's the flagpole of like when my interest is definitely not in the movie anymore is when Robin Williams is physically there. Like, I don't know what it is, but seeing his face get all emotional, I actually was less invested than when I saw Andrew's robotic face raise a little eyebrow or squint the eye or something. I don't know what it is. It's just one of those things where it's a reverse case, where the thing that has an actual human, I relate to less.
Well, for me, like the scene where he gets the human face, I was totally fine with, but like the immediate next scene was, meeting the granddaughter. And, you know, that's kind of the correlation there of like, oh, that's kind of the point where the film lost me. It's like, oh, you've finally given him the human form. But now the film's becoming the romantic comedy.
What were some other things that you wanted to talk about or bring up, both positive or negative, or just random observations through this watch?
How dare the opening credits of the film tell me that Stephen Root was in this? Did they assume that I wouldn't notice?
I thought you were going to actually say a legitimate criticism, which is it says it's in the distant, in sometime in the distant future. Then the film specifically tells us it was in 2005, which was such a weird thing to put down as a mystery and then reveal later. But yes, Stephen Root is a bit of a notorious figure for our podcast because I love Stephen Root. Talking about actors, I do always pop for when they're here. And Bartek always forgets, get face blindness, voice blindness, I guess, for Stephen Root. We've had him numerous times and so many moments I'm like, that's Stephen Root. And you're like, what?
I think my favorite one's still Idiocracy, where it's like, I specifically looked at the IMDb cast list, the Wikipedia cast list. I'm like, all right, he's not in it. Then we did the episode. Then I went back and his name was there. I'm like, what the fuck? How did I miss that?
And I'm like, he's doing a Stephen Root thing. There he is.
He's very
now,
Stephen Root.
Jokes aside, You did know who he was in this movie, yes?
Yes, I did. Like, oh, there he is, because the film spoiled it for me.
That's it. Do you think he would not have recognized him if the film didn't say Stephen Root? Because I forgot he was in it, and then I saw his name and I went,
you know, if his name,
it's Stephen Root.
If his name wasn't in the opening credits and I wasn't paying attention during the closing credits, I might have missed it.
Do you think that's a negative or a positive for Stephen Root as an actor? In your case, he's one of those character actor people that you don't like clock in everything. Like he's in so much stuff, but he's not one of those ones where you go, oh, it's such and such. But do you think that's a positive or negative for him?
I guess positive, because I've consistently liked all of his characters, even if I didn't know it was like the same guy.
It's one of those things where it's a delicate balancing act for a character actor, because some character actors are hired specifically to play that type, like
I know that voice,
that role, like that type, like I can't remember what his name was. I think his name was like Buck Flower, who was like a famous like homeless man actor in Hollywood. Like he was in Back to the Future. He was the one on the park, on like on not the park bench, but like on the bench.
Oh, was his name like Red or something?
Yeah, and he's like, oh, you know, and you would always see him, and you always play that type. Stephen Root is a legitimate character actor. He always is in things. Rarely as the lead, he will come in for a scene or two, or he'll be there as a semi-supporting character, maybe even a big supporting character. But in his case, he has had the virtue of being able to have so many different types of characters to do. Consider it, like in this movie, he's completely a different player than he was in something like Office Space, or something like Red State, or something, you know, or Krippendorf's tribe, or this, or this, or this, and yet he could easily have been pigeonholed because he's a heavy set guy, and he usually has a bit more of a, depends what role it is, but a southern drawl happens with him a lot. But
yeah, like didn't he have a slight like British accent?
Everyone did.
Yeah,
he is one of the questions. We know it's set in America, but where's it set?
Very San Francisco-y, yeah.
But everyone, Robin Williams, the family, Sam Neill's not even doing an American accent. That's just Sam Neill's voice. Like, he was so New Zealand in this. But is that just, even Oliver Platt, everyone in this movie was doing a little vocal, like a little vocal thing where they were all posh sounding. Even someone like who shouldn't be. Everyone except for the other robot had a little bit of a mannered way of speaking.
Mm.
Hello there. Like here, this isn't me talking British, but it's more reformed it, way, refined way of speaking.
It's Ryan from 2005.
Hello. 9/11 just happened a couple of years ago, and Frankie Muniz is still a star. This is how we all talk in 2005.
And then 2 years later, in 2205, you still sound like that.
Yeah, 2 years later, yeah. But no, Stephen Root was great. I liked how he got fucked over in the end.
I liked that he never really got the upper hand in any of the, like, you know, verbal back and forth. He was always the punching bag. It's like, oh, you've defeated me again, rapidly.
That's I barely earned that in a year. Just, he was such a weasel. I loved him. Anything else you want to, bring up? Any other points of conversation? Anything that you want to break down, or things that you would be remiss if we didn't talk about?
I guess this kind of already goes back to stuff we've already talked about, but going back to the nature of the film as an epic, it's. I always really like the. When you think back on these films, you can kind of segment them into like, oh, this is the era where these characters were around. Like, you know, that's what we're saying here about like that era where Sam Neill was around was great. And he's like the father figure of that era. And once he's gone, you know, you think back on him fondly. You see how some of his messages, you know, still resonate with you and the story. And there was one point where Andrew was talking to Portia and said, oh, you know, back way back when your great grandfather said, it's like, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
That was, yeah, like the fourth last generation.
Uh-huh. And just, she wouldn't have met him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just like this really big moment that just hit me like, oh, God, that would have been that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, after a certain point, you know, at the end of that long quest, like, he meets the Oliver Platt character, and he becomes this, like, constant figure in his life. And I actually quite enjoyed that, like, consistent presence throughout the rest of the film, where it's like, this is a, you know, somewhat of a friend he's got, but also the person that he can, you know, talk to the most about what he's going through, because he understands he's technologically literate.
That's a way of going about it, yes. I just didn't care for the romance stuff with him and the granddaughter. I don't think they had chemistry.
I think when we had the scene of him and Oliver Platt, like, spying on the engagement party or something, and they're, like, going back and forth, "You're in love, man." It's like, "I'm in love. My God, I think you're right." It's like, God, this just feels like a completely different film from the...
It felt like, what's it? Is it Cyrano? The story of the ugly guy with the big nose, and he's gross and physically speaking.
Oh,
but he
I've never heard that word said, but yeah, I know what
you mean. But he knows how to write really well, and so he's, like, writing and forging the handsome person to be able to woo the girl, even though they're the one that actually loves the girl, and she loves the intellect, even though the intellect is being put upon someone who doesn't have it. It was kind of like that for a moment with that, or there's the Steve Martin film Roseanne, which is based on this. And there was a Blackadder episode too. Blackadder the Third did this exact same story as well, where Blackadder had to do this for Princey, where he was trying to woo her, and Princey was just like, "I'm horny. All right, pants off time." Like, I don't know if you remember this, but that was an episode within that. But something that I just want to say is this movie's music needed to shut the fuck up. It was always on.
Oh, what is this, me and AI?
Music. No, but I feel the same. And when I, in the AI discussion, I wasn't disagreeing with you wholeheartedly there. I was like, yeah, but this one's not as loud as the AI one, but it's always there. And James Horner was a great musician, like a great composer. He was one of the greats. He did some great Star Trek themes, but Jesus Christ, shut the fuck up with the music. It was always happening, always insisting, always telling, always telling. And another huge problem of this movie is, although I like it more than I hate it, it's a series of scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it flows fully. It's a series of, like, different, like, how can we do such and such with Andrew scenes. Like, they're just a series of moments or ideas or pictures of, like, well, here's the general outline of what we're going to do with this story about a robot that becomes a human. What fills that up? Well, I guess we have a scene where this happens, and oh, he gets a lawyer, and he gets a job, and he does this, and he gets a house, and it always comes across as, like, not cohesive to me. Even though I think that first half is more so, but even then it's like, oh, we have to have a scene in which Little Miss gets upset at Andrew because she's the only one that likes Andrew, like thinks he's like other kids. So he breaks the unicorn, breaks the horse, and then, oh, I don't know what it is. There's just something about this where it's more of a series of vignettes to me than a complete narrative.
It didn't bother me that much, but, you know, to not be too much of a hypocrite, I've definitely talked about on this show that, like, when I can see the obvious structure of something, it does take me out of it.
And that goes into the back half where it no longer becomes a series of scenes that I'm here for. Like I said, this reads much more to me that the first half is much more about the headiness of the science fiction concept tied with the emotional. And then the second half, it's just melodrama, romantics. It's very sappy. It's very corny. It's just swelling score and Robin Williams being like, "Kiss me if you love me." And I'm like, what are we doing here?
I remember all of the scenes where they kept saying the thing about making mistakes. Like, I, not only was it repetitive, but I wasn't really following it. Like, wait, what? Would you, okay.
But he destroyed her with facts and logic because she wasn't doing her own advice. So she then had to get with Andrew. That's another thing. These men these faceless men that get married are just vilified, and yet we don't know a single thing about
them. I don't think they have dialogue.
No, the son does. Like her, the little Mrs. Shitty son, Lloyd, when he grows up.
He does. I'm talking about the.
I know. Both of them. Like both of the.
But Little Miss and Portia's fiance is that Aunt Robin Williams.
Who are played by different actors. Like, that's something that they did at least. Yeah, wasn't the true. Same guy. But Lloyd.
That second guy did have a nice chin, though.
Yes, and they made jokes about it. Robin Williams had an improv, and everyone liked it. what I was going to say is, you mentioned Jordan Peele a little while ago.
Jordan. I couldn't remember his first name.
He won an Oscar for Get Out.
Mm-hmm.
And Lloyd, the shitty son, and Andrew's new lawyer, that's Bradley Whitford, who was in Get Out. He was the dad.
Okay.
In that film, Get Out.
I haven't seen it.
But... And he's in a million things. I just should highlight that. And the first lawyer that they had, the one that let him get a bank account, was played by John Michael.
Friends with Samuel,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was played by John Michael Higgins. And he is one of those comedic actors that you see a lot. I'm pretty sure he was in Dodgeball as like the other co-announcer of Dodgeball, like when they're doing like the... You know what I'm talking about. I may be mixing him. No, that was Jason Bateman and Gary Cole. He's the exact same type of character in the Pitch Perfect movies, but John Michael Higgins, you would, like, he's that guy with, like, a voice, like the announcer voice. Hello there.
Mm-hmm.
And he always plays that type, so I was just amused to see him physically turn up here and not do that voice the whole way through. Like, yeah, if you look at his career, a lot of voice acting, because he has that old-timey presenter voice.
Right.
Hello. And he's very good, but I was just shocked to see him here and he wasn't being funny. This movie has some comedic actors here that aren't being funny, and you always wonder if that's a good thing or not, but I think it works out well in the end for this.
Going back to what you were saying about the vignettes, like I pretty much only read the trivia points about this film. I didn't look into like the trailers or anything like that. But a big thing that they were talking about was that there was just shitloads and shitloads of things that were cut.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, like, should have probably watched the trailer at least, but apparently the trailer is just full of scenes that aren't in the film. I have heard that, yeah, Robin Williams had a falling out with Disney over this film because of certain things being cut out. It just feels...
Mm-hmm. There's a whole entire thing about Robin Williams and his... contentious relationship with Disney and lawsuits. And
yeah.
There's a whole entire saga about
Disney
it.
Disney Ellis had a video about it.
Yes, yes.
Did I say Disney Ellis?
Yes. 2 years. Disney Ellis. Lindsay Ellis, the video essayist. Yes.
May as well be Disney Ellis.
Yeah, sure. But I guess I just have to, just again, this is my final point, and it's an obvious point. I just firmly land on, it's still the same problem for me with this movie, where I will say I like it overall. I have a fondness for it. It still hits me in the emotional points. There are moments of sweetness and tenderness, and yet it also gets me thinking. I can appreciate all of these performances and the characters. And yet, that second half, I can't say it's like a mess, but it just, I lose touch with the film because I think the film lost touch with itself.
Hmm.
And even in this discussion, we pinpointed down some things about it, but it's not, I guess this is a fascination. It's not one of those movies that we have covered on the podcast, say, where I can firmly say, like, this is my problem with it. Like, this, and I can say it and, like, I'm reassured, knowing that that's why I have these little niggling things or these big ones. This is one where it's like, even now, as I'm wrapping the conversation up, I'm still, like, uneasy about, like, why is it that I find the second half just not that engaging? It's still utilizing the same things and escalating them to natural dramatic points, but man, I just am not invested. It's just one of those things where it's like, even though I've mentioned my reasons for why that could be the case, I'm still unsure about it, even as I say, sure, check out Bicentennial Man.
No,
it's a fine enough film.
That's fair enough to say. Like, I still like the whole, you know, through-line narrative of, like, becoming more human, even when it became a bit more literal towards the end. But it's just all the things that were happening alongside that towards the end that was just like, oh, come on, can we shake it up a bit more?
I know people that hate this movie. Julio from the Contrarians gave this a 1 star out of 5. And I don't know why he didn't write a review. I'd have to ask him if he listens to this. Maybe he can tell us. He must hate how sappy and emotional it is. Or maybe that Robin Williams wasn't funny enough. That was a lot of the complaints I read online, was they wanted Robin Williams to do the Robin Williams thing the whole time. That scene where he does the jokes for the family, that's what people wanted for the whole movie. They wanted Robin Williams to be the funny robot. And the fact that he isn't all of the time the funny robot, you know, gets people annoyed.
I mean, he's pretty funny in most scenes.
Yeah.
No, I figured that'd be good enough.
I think so too. And that is all. Now, nothing else you recommend?
I recommend the film. There's problems, but I'm totally fine watching that all the way through.
If you need a good sleep aid, according to Bartek's dad.
I wonder if my dad would like the film if you watched all of it.
Maybe you need to do it in 2 parts for him.
Ah, the way Christopher Columbus intended.
Christopher Columbus.
Hey, man, America doesn't have Columbus Day anymore, because you know what you did back in 1492.
I haven't looked at his filmography.
Didn't you do the first Harry Potters?
First two.
Yeah.
I was going to say, did he go on to do that pretty much after this? Because behind the scenes is he felt that he was he was the wrong director.
He didn't know what he was signing up for, I think.
He had never done a science fiction film before, is what he says. And I haven't gone back through, I've gone through his catalog to be like, yeah, sure. He went on to do Pixels, so I guess he must have been fine.
I think that was the true point. He didn't do one again until Pixels.
Oh, great. That one he nailed. But let's hear what we are going to be talking about next time on the podcast. Now, we have our listeners' pick, and the list is getting a bit thin, and most of them are foreign films that I haven't been able to find copies of. So we're doing one that maybe would be suited to another time of year, but we're doing it anyway. We're going to talk about The Omen.
Oh, the one I just put on the list.
I didn't realize. Well, we're going to talk about The Omen.
It was like 2 weeks ago.
The original Omen film, of course, from the 1970s. Not any of the sequels or remakes, but guess who plays the adult version of Damien from The Omen? Damien is, of course, the evil child in The Omen. Now, they grow up in the third film to be played by a certain actor. Have a guess. Late, I think, 80s, this movie, maybe 90s? Take a guess.
Is it an apt choice considering we just did Bicentennial Man?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Robin Williams?
No.
Sam Neill?
Yes. Sam Neill.
Okay.
Sam Neill played the adult version of Damien, and his whole thing was, I believe, I haven't watched it myself, but I think his whole thing is he's running for president.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing of that. And so we'll be watching the original, but I guess it flows on nicely from this because Sam Neill's weird connections. So there you go. The Neill connection. Oh, we didn't bring this up. Sam Neill, funny guy. I don't know if you saw these ads growing up, because I know you weren't as heavy on watching broadcast TV. You were more of a cable kid than I was. But on regular broadcast TV here in Australia, they had these ads for meat. Meat is a big industry in Australia. Every Australia Day, we have these lamb ads, and they become like these extravagant things over the years. But we have these other ads that are just like, have you tried eating red meat? Red meat, it's good for you. Eat red meat. And Sam Neill, for like 5 years or more, was doing a series of ads where he was encouraging you to eat red meat. But they were very funny and strange, and the way he did them was as if he was like a David Attenborough type narrator figure, but he was physically there, and he's like watching we're watching a family at the dinner table, and he's doing like a David Attenborough type narration of like, look at the youngest one sinking their teeth into the meat and blah, blah, blah. And then it would pan out and he's in a tree near a window looking in on the family like he's a fucking freak pervert who's watching them. And there was always like that, and then at the end of each ad, he would do a little song and a little dance telling everyone, come on, everybody, eat red meat. And he does, this is the only way I can describe the dances he would do. He does the dance of a dad who's a little bit tipsy at a New Year's Eve party. I don't know if you remember any of these ads, but they were always playing of just Sam Neill inexplicably being like, Have you tried eating red meat before? Eat red meat. Come on, everybody, and does a little dance. And there are always just these funny little ads of, and they're like little running continuity between them. Very strange. I don't know. Do you remember these at all?
Maybe I've seen one, but I don't recall.
Ah, they were great. Sam Neill, thank you for the hard work that you've done. One of my favorite actors. We all say that we all know he's from New Zealand, but he's one of those where it feels like Australia's stolen him as one of ours, like how we deal with Russell Crowe from time to time.
Was he the old man in the Wilder People?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hunt for the Wilder People? Yeah. Is he the old man in Hunt for... Yes, he has a big beard nowadays. Mm. And he was on our friend Sam Peterson's podcast a few times.
Yeah.
So there's that. But you can find Spit and Polish Presents on all of your podcasting sites of choice, including YouTube. You can rate and review our podcast if you have liked what you've heard here. And if you want to send a film recommendation our way, you can do so via the social medias of Facebook and Twitter, Spit and Polish Presents, or you can send an email over to which email address, Bartek?
I think it was spitandpolished@gmail.com. That's spitandpolished@gmail.com.
It's all in the description of this episode for your convenience in case you didn't write them down yourself while we were explaining it to you. This was what they call exposition.
Yeah.
Necessary dialogue.
If you're on YouTube, you can use the transcribe option to read the words. But you know, the last 2 days, it hasn't been working for me, so hopefully they fix it.
Hopefully YouTube fixes it. They killed Google Podcasts so that all podcasts are on YouTube now. So they better fix the fucking transcriptions on YouTube. Just saying.
Yeah, that, just saying. Like a week or two or week and a half after this episode comes out, it'll be the 10-year anniversary of Robin Williams' death.
That's actually very sad. Mm. Yeah, I didn't realize that. But
it's like mid-April 2013. Mid-April.
Wow. 2013, 2014.
I said 2014.
Let's play it back.
2 years.